good evening, and welcome once again to another episode of Curtain Call, where each and every week I spotlight the magic of theater, one conversation at a time. And I'm your host tonight, and every night, Tom Candela. You know, some stories are carefully written, rehearsed, and performed exactly the same way night after night. Others are created in the moment, with no script or safety net, and no idea where the performers might end up. Tonight, we're going to explore both worlds with a guest whose career has been built on imagination, spontaneity, and the remarkable power of storytelling. Before the evening is over, we're going to take you behind the scenes of the acclaimed improvisational theater company Broadway's next hit musical. We're going to meet the novelist and memoir writer behind some of the wonderfully heartfelt stories, and we're going to hear about an exciting new production of Our Town, and it's coming to our region this fall. It is also time for another episode of
The Roving Thespian.
That's me. And on this episode, I roved. Is that even a word, roved? Well, I went to Hurleyville, New York, and a fine town that is, Hurleyville. And I went there, and I spoke with some of the audience members of a staged reading I happened to go see at the Hurleyville Museum. Be sure to stay tuned also after the conversation for a look at some of the wonderful theater and performing arts events happening throughout our listening area in the days and weeks ahead. With that said, take your seat, everybody. The overture is about to begin. Let's raise the curtain on another great conversation, as the show begins right now. Tonight on the show, we're going to welcome a performer, a writer, a director, storyteller, whose career has traveled through improvisational comedy, themed entertainment, memoir writing, live events, novels, and classic American theater. We're going to talk a lot about that. Greg Triggs, many of you may know that name. He is the MC and co-producer of Broadway's next hit musical, the long-running improvised musical comedy experience, where audiences help create a brand new musical every single night. He is also directing and creating live entertainment experiences for Disney, SeaWorld, Carnegie Hall, the Tribeca Film Festival. In addition, he is an accomplished novelist and a memoir storyteller whose deeply personal and often funny writing explores family, memory, identity, resilience, and the complicated contradictions of everyday life. And this very fall, Greg will be directing a new production of Our Town. It's going to be presented at the Tustin Theater as part of the Delaware Valley Art Alliance 50th anniversary celebration. Tonight, we're going to discuss a little bit of all of that right here on Curtain Call. Greg, I want to welcome you to the show.
I'm so excited to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're here. So, as I said, there's so many things that you have done in your career. We'll start with this question, Greg. For listeners who don't know what Broadway's next hit musical is, can you give us a little idea of what an audience member walking into one of those shows can expect?
Well, I'm very proud of Broadway's next hit musical. It combines live music, stand-up comedy, short-form improvisation, and long-form improvisation. So you walk into a lobby, and it is a red carpet experience for the Phony Awards, which is a parody of the Tony Awards. And the first half of the musical is four nominated musicals. The audience votes on which one of them is the winner or their favorite, the most compelling story. And then the second half of the show is a fully improvised full production of that award-winning musical with costumes, with choreography, with props, with live music, and the entire cast puts that together in probably maybe 40 minutes.
Let's be clear. The audience is the participating factor here, right?
Everything is based on the audience ideas. They give us the song titles that help us build the world of the musical, and then we present those four, and they vote on their favorite. It's about 90 to 100 minutes, the total experience, plus whenever you arrive. So everyone can buy wine or beer or whatever they want. And the show goes in so many different places, and it goes to so many different worlds. And as an improviser, as a comedian, I think part of your ethic has to be, how do I keep my show fresh? So going around the world performing Broadway's Next Hit Musical always brings fresh inspiration. And very often these days, we perform the show at 54 Below in Manhattan. We are their only comedy group, one of the only house performances that they have.
So again, when you're improvising dialogue, that's one thing. When you're improvising music and lyrics and choreography, that's a totally different animal. How does that all come together?
Well, it's all built on trust. Mm. Trust of yourself, trust of the musician, trust of your fellow performers, and probably most importantly, the trust of the audience. So many people, it's been my experience, get very hung up on the concept of things needing to be perfect. I think for something to be fully realized, it needs to be honest. And if it's honest, that's what people are going to hold the story on. So if you chase a joke or you sell out the long story for one beat that ruins the integrity of your character, you're doing a disservice to the totality and the experience that you are building with the audience.
What is going on behind the scenes? You give the audience this opportunity to come up with ideas. So you have, let's say, a bunch of ideas and you present that to the cast. That's backstage, I assume, right? And you come to them and you say, okay, folks, this is what we have. This, 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 and this. What is the process now for them backstage to put that show together to bring out 40 minutes later a full production?
Well, I like to think that improvisation is about the consequence of exploring possibility instead of limitation.
Okay.
What can something become rather than what can't it become? I think that's a good way to live your life, too.
Yeah.
Within that dynamic, we're all looking for inspiration. So in addition to creating moments for ourselves, there's an ethic in good improvisation where you think about how you can make the rest of the cast look good, set up a moment that filters through their talent. And also, I think one of the reasons there is so much tension in the world right now is a lot of people do not feel seen.
Right.
So it is always my goal when I'm on the red carpet or when I'm interacting with the audience or performing with another performer, I want to send the message on some level, I see you and what you are adding is affecting me. We're building this together. That builds a beautiful, in my experience, momentum that surprises and hopefully delights everybody. I also do stand-up comedy sometimes, which I enjoy because it has great autonomy. But I love being in a situation that is the consequence of ideas that I would not have thought of alone.
So listening is very important. What can you say about that as far as you listening to what the audience is giving you back?
When I was a young performer, you're thinking, I've got to build the pyramids. How do I get a career built on firm ground that's going to provide for me, excite me, and allow me to tell stories that I want to tell? And so it's been my experience that when you first start out, you're almost vomiting ideas just to see what sticks. Eventually, I ended up performing full-time at Walt Disney World, and I had a wonderful show director who talked about two things. Number one, that in my type of work, you almost have a contract with the audience where you have to show them that you are there for them rather than for yourself.
Okay.
And then the other thing that he taught me, his name is Chris Oyen, he taught me that energy does not die. It takes other forms. One of the ways you do that is by listening very actively.
Yes.
And a million years ago, back in Minneapolis, where I learned to improvise, I was broke. I was poor, and my car broke down. And that day, I was going to have to choose between having lunch or getting my car fixed. I chose getting my car fixed. So I pulled into this gas station. The mechanic looked at me with a funny look, and he said, "I can feel every atom in my body." And I was confused. And he repeated it, and he said, "I can feel every atom in my body." And I still looked confused, and he said, "You don't remember saying that?" And I said, "No." And he said, "My wife and I saw you in a show about 2 weeks ago. You said that. It cracked us up. We have been going around the house saying that ever since." And he fixed my car for free.
Wow.
I love that story, not just because I got my car fixed for free, but because it just proves, within my experience at least, that you don't know what your contributions go on to become. And I guess that gives me hope when improv feels a little disposable. I think one of the reasons I started writing books, I'm married to a ceramic sculptor who's very talented, and he's in quite a few museum collections. And I've always thought, well, his work's going to survive forever. Mine's disposable. And my books have led to a permanence or a benchmark in the timeline. But I love thinking about that guy. And of course, I don't know what happened to him. I wish I could hunt down he and his wife and just thank them for what has proven to be a very valuable lesson.
Wow, that's a great story. And hopefully you were able to go and get lunch.
I think I went to Kentucky Fried Chicken that day.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, the theater that he saw me at, I was doing a show and a bunch of guys in suits stopped me outside of the theater after a show and explained that they were from Disney and asked me to meet with them the next day about a potential job. And that unlocked the next 12 years of my life. So it's
That's
kind
amazing.
Of an allegory to improv. You make one choice, it leads to another choice. You find yourself in another situation. And hopefully as you go along, you're developing a shorthand and a muscle that allows you to make better choices.
That's an amazing connection there, because you did spend a lot of time working with Disney.
36 years now.
Yeah, tell us
I've never had a year where I've not worked for Disney. I started out at what are now called the Hollywood Studios in a show called Streetmosphere, which was a creation of Hollywood in the 1940s. And then I moved over to Pleasure Island and did two shows called The Adventurers Club and The Comedy Warehouse, where I was for the longest time. And in that show, I was doing short form improvisation. About 8 years into my Disney experience, I thought, my undergrad's in directing, and so I thought, I feel like I've finally got a foundation in this community and I can start to pursue directing work. So for about the next 4 years, I'd go from directing projects back to performing back and forth, depending on where Disney thought I was best suited at that time. And I worked on the Super Bowl halftime show in 2000 with Phil Collins and Christina Aguilera and Enrique Iglesias and Tony Braxton. Around that time, I started thinking, well, I've always wanted to live in New York. I need to do something about that. And one of my co-stars at the Comedy Warehouse said, "Oh, you should have lunch with my brother while you're there." Yeah. And now I'm married to his brother.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So again, one step in front of the other.
Was there electric that first meeting, that very first time you saw him?
I met Matt Nolan, to whom I'm married, at his studio. And they had to let you into the building and then let you into the elevator. And then they had to call the elevator up.
Uh-huh.
And the elevator doors opened and Matt was standing there. And I remember my first look at him took my breath away, and been together ever since.
Wonderful.
Ever since that lunch.
Wonderful story. Great. Another thing that I really liked about seeing your performance was we don't see you think. What I was taken by too is how quick you were. And that's what I mean by you don't see, I didn't see you think. It wasn't like, oh, what do I do now? I got to think of something funny. Oh, here it is. It was like one right after the other. What's going on inside your head when you're on stage?
Well, thank you for those kind words.
Oh, yeah.
And one of my primary goals that night was to make sure I made the choice to bring a child up. Mm-hmm. And I had to make sure that child felt safe and heard, and that his contributions were going to be part of the story. Yeah. So that was part of what was going on for me. But a creative career is built on lessons learned in part from people you've been lucky enough to work with. Mm-hmm. And I used to work with this stand-up comedian who was a Broadway actor who Disney hired to do improv named Budge Threlkeld. And I was writing my first novel, and Budge was in ill health. So I was calling him every couple of days just to check in on him. And he asked me how the book was going. And I said, oh, this big emotional thing happened, and I'm struggling with it. And he said, you're overthinking it. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, be quiet, quit thinking, and the story will tell you where it wants to go. And that was life-changing. It was life-changing for my book, and it was also life-changing for me as a performer. One of our best friends is Eve Behar, who is the daughter of Joy Behar from The View. Sure. And one time we were visiting them in the Hamptons. My life sounds much fancier than it is. And Joy asked me if I had seen the show lately. And I said, yeah. And she said, what did you think? What are you thinking about the show lately? Mm-hmm. I said, well, and I'm just pulling a name out of the air. I said, you didn't have much to say to Julia Roberts on Friday. And she said, yeah, I didn't like the movie that she was there to promote. So I just let the others do the lifting. And my head exploded. Yeah. And I said, you mean when you have a movie star as big as Julia Roberts, you do not pretend to enjoy the movie? And she said, nope, absolutely not. My audience needs to know that I am telling them the truth. Julia Roberts has a wonderful life. She doesn't care what I think about this movie. But to my audience, I must always be honest. And I think I already knew that, but it certainly helped me commit to that thought that I'm not going to say things that are blatantly unkind. I'm going to do my best not to make people feel foolish. I'm going to try to build my comedy on affirmation and honesty, not worry about perfection, concentrate on sincerity and honesty.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that has served me well. There have been times where I have spoken my truth. I might get a negative reaction. A negative reaction is still a reaction. A negative reaction is still energy from an audience, and I get to react to the negative reaction, and together we're going to figure it out. I think sometimes you have to give up on right and wrong to find the common ground.
Mm-hmm.
Easier said than done, although it took me a long time to come up with that thought. But yeah. At the end of the day, I think most of us have more in common than we have that separates us.
Yeah.
I like to think so.
And it's finding that common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that, too, is part of comedy, right? What really makes a lot of things funny is when we recognize ourselves in what you're talking about. Common things that we're all familiar with and in the moment stuff.
Well, I've been doing it for 40 years, and what an honor it is to still have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that sounds fatalistic. I don't mean it that way. But sometimes when I'm in front of an audience, if I need some fresh inspiration, I'll try to remember that 500 people are deciding whether they like me or not.
But do you worry about that while on stage?
I don't worry about it. I try to find the inspiration in it.
Uh-huh.
Because I will say, with a little bit of ego, I don't think I've ever phoned in a show. And I'm very proud of that.
If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Greg Triggs. I've been talking a lot about his stand-up comic experience and his history in the theater. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about his writing. And of course, we're going to talk about the upcoming play, Our Town, which is going to be featured this October over at the Tustin Theater. Stick with us.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, AI is projected to drastically increase demand for electricity, so some tech firms are looking skyward.
Basically, the concept is that you move AI into space, and you use orbiting solar panels that are in sunlight all the time.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Okay, and we are back with Greg Triggs. We're in the studio today. It's a pleasure to have you here. So speaking of the studio.
Well, I have a meeting about that right after this interview,
today.
As a matter
okay.
of fact. We're at the Yarnslingers show, which I produce and appear with in Sullivan County and Pennsylvania, and looking at how that might become a radio show and a podcast. I try to be very specific with whom I engage. I want to create opportunities for people that I'm excited to have the opportunities. So Yarnslingers, as a matter of fact, in addition to discussion about the podcast and our ongoing shows around the community, we are releasing our first book this year. It's called This Happened, Yarnslingers Book One.
Wow, fantastic.
25 local writers, many of whom are being published for the first time.
Yarnslingers is a very specific type of writing. It's memoir writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the writers are limited by the number of words they can use. Talk about that and how difficult that can be for a writer, particularly a writer like me who tends to give me a page and it's like 10 pages and I got to edit it down.
I love the prohibition of having a word count in Yarnslingers. It can be argued that writing, there's a subliminal effect where the reader knows whether or not you are using their time well, when there is padding, when there is extra words, when it is inefficient. It hurts the pacing. It hurts the energy.
Yeah.
And so within Yarnslingers, for everyone to have the common word count, it means you're working within the same framework. Now, the variety in Yarnslingers comes through the theme of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So some of our past themes have been boundaries, the kiss, work, school days. However people get into their version of the memory about which they're writing, the theme provides that, but then the consistency comes from the word count.
750 words, right?
Is it? Usually, it depends on the number of writers. Sometimes, if 11 writers want to do on the show, we're kicking the word count down to use the audience's time well. If we only have 6 writers, we might take it to 825 words. It's a variable.
Yeah, yeah. Economy of words. You got to be skilled to do that.
Well, we very often will welcome someone who is exploring their writing. And very often, the first time someone does Yarnslingers, they get a little emotional because they are writing about something that they have yet to process.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're bringing back someone who has maybe passed away or is no longer part of their life.
Right.
Or they're telling a story about a heightened moment. So it really brings forth a lot of emotion in a very touching way.
Nice.
It's exciting to see the evolution of writers as they go along the path in Yarnslingers. And I have to give a shout out to Ramona Jan, who was the creator of that show. She has helped so many writers find their voice.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So bravo if you're listening, Ramona. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about some of your pieces that I read, which I thought were fantastic. One of them was when you were a young boy and your dad's friend, is it Dominic or Dom?
D-
Don, dressed up as Santa Claus. And I still have this image of Don climbing a ladder out back by the shed or by the back of the house to get onto the roof and coming down and falling into a tree, but beard askew, still coming into the house through the back door as Santa Claus. I found it both humorous and in some ways there was a lot of emotional pain in there. Do you find that when you write that you blend your humor with emotional pain?
Yes. One of the things that's wonderful about Yarn Slingers is after a career with Disney and a career doing comedy, you can explore the duality of, I guess, what I would call pathos. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's very important. Don, of whom you were speaking, and my father both had addiction issues.
Yeah. And which you talk about. Yeah.
And I think in a lot of writing, they would simply be the two alcoholics. But there was such a sweetness in that particular story about them wanting to give us Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And there are the broad strokes with which we can describe another person. But no one is just those headlines, right? And it's really important to me in my writing. I also have two challenged siblings. One of my sisters is blind.
Yes.
And my youngest brother is intellectually disabled. And again, it's a story where that's just what they are. But they are so much more than that first thing that you might use to describe them upon meeting them. And that's one of the gifts of writing, I think, is you can stay with those thoughts and those feelings. You can ponder them. And then after doing so, you can turn them into the consequence of having gone through it.
Mm-hmm.
And without sounding judgmental, I hope, Don has probably been gone for about 35 years. How wonderful is it that we're talking about him?
Yeah.
How would Don feel to know that he is being talked about on public radio over 30 years after his passing? And I think that's one of the things I really love about Yarn Slingers is it brings back a lot of people who were beloved.
Mm-hmm. What I loved at the very end there, your sister who is blind says to you, you know that was Don, right? She can't see, but she was able to touch his face and knew, sense memory in her fingertips of who that was. I thought that was absolutely beautiful, the way to end that story.
Well, and thank you.
Yeah.
And also that she let Don have his version of the experience.
Yeah. Yeah, she didn't give
feel
it up.
She didn't feel the need to say, Don, quit pretending to be Santa Claus.
Exactly.
She let him be Santa Claus.
Yeah, I love that. The other piece that I read was about moving your brother into an assisted living facility. There's a lot of focus on objects, which meant something to you. The bed frame, sleeping that last time in that childhood bed that was handed down through the children and was yours at one time, then became your brother's. How often do you use that, and how important is bringing objects that hold memories into your stories?
I like to do that when it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a heightened experience for me. It was like saying goodbye to my mother again, because
exactly.
I was deciding what was going to go with my brother, what was going to be given away, what I was going to take. And isn't it, well, to me, it's interesting. You're in a bed that originally belonged to your eldest brother who unfortunately passed away. Then it was me. Then it was my brother. And I was the last of the three of us who was ever going to sleep in that bed. And you think about your childhood bed and all you pondered and all you dreamt of and all you hoped for. And to be given the honor of having one last night to think about those things and say goodbye to it with whatever maturity you have earned was really precious
yeah.
to me. And when you're writing, again, for me, the goal is fully realized moments or a version of honesty, but you have to find a way in for the audience. So in that particular story, the memories that those things hold or the consequence
sure.
was very important.
Yeah, and as a reader, I got that. There was so much power in that last night that you speak of, lying in that bed and thinking of the history of what that bed frame held, what it saw, what it witnessed. You kind of get that. I thought it was beautiful. And again, I remind it in 750 words.
Yes, yes. And if anyone is interested, quite a few of those essays are published on a blog at yeah. gregtriggs.com.
Good. I'm glad you gave that out. Is there also a website that you have, Greg?
Yes, gregtriggs.com.
Same place.
Okay. And yarnslingers.com, broadwaysnexthitmusical.com.
All right. So all of those things could be found on the internet.
Exactly.
Very easy. You also have a couple of novels out. Let's mm-hmm. talk about those, because I ordered both of them. One I ordered as an audiobook because you're the narrator.
Recorded in this very studio.
Recorded in this very... That's another nice part of it that I didn't know. Give us the bridge between memoir writing and novel writing.
My mother, in the bedroom that contained the bed we were just speaking of, it was a small bedroom on the east side in Madison, Wisconsin, and the walls were lined with paperbacks, the kind of pocketbooks I think they were called back mm-hmm. then. When I was bored, I would just pick up a book. And I probably read things that were far too mature for my young mind. I think I read all of Jacqueline Suzanne's novels before okay. I was 10. And when I left Disney in 2003, I thought I'd go crazy. And I had a newspaper column at the time. And when I wrote to say goodbye to my life in Orlando, Florida, I had written, never again will I live in a town where there are fireworks every night. Mm. And I was looking at that and I thought, that's a really good illusion for a romantic comedy. And I thought, I'm going to write that book. And I did. And it's called The Next Happiest Place on Earth. Mm-hmm. And it tells the story of a woman who is divorced unexpectedly, reinventing her life at a theme park in Orlando, Florida. Super fun to write. And I love the book. And the minute you write your first book, you hope that there'll be enough demand that it's worthy of the time it would take yeah. to write a second book.
Sure.
There was a story I had about my brother Art, who, as I mentioned, was my eldest brother. When he was a child, when his father died, Art was my half-brother. He was so worried about his family having enough food that Art just went and bought a bunch of corn seed without knowing how to do that at 7 years old and just started planting corn seed wow. indiscriminately around the front yard. And so my mother, as a young widow, comes home, 31 years old, and all of a sudden there are all these strange little sprouts popping up in her front yard. And Art comes out and admits that he has planted corn.
To feed the family.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And my mother was wonderful, but I think a lot of fathers from the 1950s probably would have worried about what the neighbors thought and how the yard looked.
Sure.
But my mom just staked up all those corn stalks and waited for the harvest, and they all enjoyed having corn.
Oh, I love it.
And I thought that that was such a revealing aspect of my brother's characters, and I thought it would be wonderful to write a story about that. So I started writing a book about my brother and I, and then I realized I was missing my entire family. So in that book, I always say it's 70% memoir, 30% fiction, and it was a wonderful experience, and I think it was good for my family, too.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did they read it?
Yes.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Did they see themselves in the characters?
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, you don't know the consequence of your actions, and sometimes you're lucky enough to find it. I was recently at a family funeral of someone who is in the book, and people brought books for me to sign
wow.
at the funeral, in a way that was touching and surreal.
Yeah,
I didn't expect those worlds to collide that day, but it also felt like it included the person who we were there to honor. So surprising. And isn't it wonderful to be in your 60s and still have life surprising you?
Yes. It can be uncomfortable, right? Sorry for your loss. Do you mind signing this?
But they weren't that quick. Okay. They worked up their courage, but it was unexpected. That book is called That Which Makes Us Stronger.
And that could be found on Amazon and places where books are sold.
Exactly. Amazon, it's in the Western Sullivan Public Library book system. It's on Audible. It's available as Kindle or a paperback. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Yarn Slingers book is coming out, and it will hopefully be available at all local book outlets, Yarn Slingers events, and Amazon.
Fantastic. Okay. And you can find both those books, The Next Happiest Place on Earth and That Which Makes Us Stronger, both on Amazon and wherever books are sold.
Good books.
Where good books are sold. Exactly. What do you find harder, though, improvising on stage or writing a novel?
Improv, you're not doing it unless there's an audience. So it is an immediate gratification. Writing a novel is a delayed gratification. Mm. I do have a lot of different experiences that kind of turn into one career. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because I like variety. So I like having a combination of immediate gratification and delayed gratification. I will tell you that writing books is much more of a vulnerable project than comedy can be. It exists past the moment it's being performed or done, and people bring their own experience to it. And in that regard, boy, do I love online reviews. Even if they're negative, I'm curious about what I missed seeing or how I might have been able to bring those people into the story more. But also people talking about how reading the book affected them when they were reading it. It's, I think, That Which Makes Us Stronger is about 300 pages long. Again, people are giving you the gift of investing a lot of their time. Mm-hmm. And I really love reading what it did or did not mean to them. I learned from it. I remember the day I finished That Which Makes Us Stronger. Mm-hmm. I was typing and I had it in my head that there needed to be another scene. And then I realized the book was over. And I walked into the living room and I said, Matt, I think I just finished the book. Mm. But that was because of my friend Budge, who said, if you shut up and get out of the way, the story will tell you what it needs, what it wants, where it's going to go.
And when it's over.
Yep. Yeah. So
what's the next book? Tell us when that's
coming.
Well,
the next book is the Yarn Slingers book.
Okay, the Yarn Slingers.
That is called This Happened. Mm-hmm. It features 25 writers from Sullivan County, all doing personal experience, memoir-based, on a common theme and word count, stories. And that will be coming out from Red Hawk Publications.
So there will also be places to purchase, I assume.
There will be a plethora of places.
Ooh, I love that.
If you buy it at the Yarn Slingers event, you can have your favorite writers sign it for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And they'll be there to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's something to look forward to.
And very important also to thank the DVAA, who has provided some grant money to make this happen.
Oh, nice. Yeah. They're fantastic. It really is.
We're so lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good segue into the next segment, Greg, because DVAA will be, I don't know if they're producing or they're featuring, but they're involved in this show that you're directing at the Tustin Theater coming up this fall. And when you want to talk about memoir and family, there it is. This is Thornton Wilder's Our Town. I had the privilege of coming to a table reading, they call it, recently with all local actors. It was fantastic. Why this play now?
Well, this play has always been in my top five. I was lucky enough to read it as a teenager when I was George and Emily's age. I was lucky enough to play George in a production of the show. And one of the things I love about the play is it reminds you of the foundation that is provided by family and community. I think that a play like Our Town brings it back to that simplicity and has the opportunity to remind people of what is really important.
Yeah.
And to acknowledge that perhaps we don't know or see everything in the moment it's unfolding. It comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
And this play is celebrating the 50th anniversary of DVAA. The organization that eventually evolved into DVAA started in 1976 by producing Our Town as a community production.
Right, right.
Now, I've always dreamed of directing this. And to do Our Town in Our Town is really exciting.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing how it resonates in Narrowsburg and the larger community. It's such a beautiful play, and Thornton Wilder and I are from the same hometown.
Oh.
So his writing has always been on my radar.
So again, a lot of the themes connect to some of your memoir writing, your personal memoir mm-hmm. writing. Of family and nostalgia. Certainly.
I guess I'm getting of an age where you can see how everything threads together yeah. and the common themes they
yeah.
have.
Yeah, but you didn't pick the play for that reason.
I didn't even pick the play. It was chosen to celebrate the 50th anniversary, and then I pushed everyone else who wanted to direct it out of the way.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
And you won that.
Yes.
And a nice thing is, at that table reading, the original Emily from 50 years ago was there in the audience, and she had some reviews or papers and stuff like
that. She had her original play.
Yeah, the script, right?
And she had gone on to become a school teacher in the community. Think of all the lives she touched in the last 50 years, and the play still matters to her. It was not unlike that mechanic.
Yeah.
Things line up and show you that there's something happening underneath it all that you didn't even realize was going to be part of the experience.
Yeah, that was so cool. I wanted an interviewer, but she was all over the place. People wanted a part of her and wanted to take pictures with her. And then she was waiting for me at one moment, and I was interviewing, I forget who, and then she left. And I was like, oh, I missed that opportunity.
Well, maybe you can interview her in October when the show opens.
Yeah. Look forward to that. So casting, as I mentioned, and of course, you're not going to give anything away, but everybody at that table I thought was great, you know, and I mentioned this because I did a little segment. If you remember, I interviewed you for it, and that I tagged that on. I interviewed Lexi, and I interviewed an audience member that day, and that was a part of the Roving Thespian segment. I forget what week it was. But anyway, everybody at that table was really good. And there was no rehearsal for it, right?
No.
They just read it. But they didn't just read it. They performed it nearly, especially Susan Mendoza, right? I mean, she was just—
Wasn't she wonderful?
Oh, she was great. She nailed it. I mean, it was beautiful. So casting, you had the auditions last week. How'd it go?
I was thrilled.
Yeah.
An abundance of choices,
yeah,
which is a wonderful thing as a director, but also a little heartbreaking because you know you're going to disappoint a couple of people.
Yeah.
It's, again, not unlike improv. You bring someone else into the experience on this play that you've read multiple times since you were a teenager, preparing for the show, preparing for the auditions, deciding which scenes are going to be read. You hear something new because of the new person interpreting it. How exciting. And my undergrad is in directing. My advisor for my directing major was named Dr. Gloria Link. And she said that the essence of directing is to create a community and facilitate an experience that everyone feels as though they had a hand in creating it. So I've always taken that to say, be ready for other ideas. Be ready to see how other people's experience bumps up against the foundation of what you think this is going to be. Allow it to become more as more people touch it. Mm-hmm. And that reading certainly felt like that. The auditions felt like that. And if the set design goes the way that I think it's going to go, I think your observation about the bed frame and the consequence of things or materials that make up a life, I think you'll see that in the final product.
I love hearing that. So you think you have your cast, basically?
We are so close to finalizing casting.
That's great. Anyways, give us when the show is going to appear.
The show is going to be in the middle of October. Opening weekend will be October 15, 16, and 17, with performances the week after as well. And if anyone listening is interested in being involved, part of the production concept involves a choir.
Oh, that's right.
And one of the things I love about that is if you can be there for three or four of the performances, you just sing along with the hymnal. And if you can't be there on the fourth show, the world won't stop spinning. We've got a choir. So it's an opportunity for more people to be involved without making the months-long commitment.
Great. And one last time, where do they go to get the information for that?
The DVAA's website, DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org.
Very good.
You can learn more about Broadway's Next Hit Musical at BroadwaysNextHitMusical.com. And if you're interested in reading more, go to yarnslingers.com. It will have a link to buy the book.
Perfect.
This happened.
We've been speaking with Greg Triggs, a man of many hats that we've learned today, and it's been a pure pleasure having you in the studio today.
Well, my thanks once again to Greg Triggs for joining me tonight. You know, I have a feeling we only scratched the surface. No, I don't have a feeling. I know we only scratched the surface of this man's remarkable career, from improvisational comedy and live entertainment, novel writing. By the way, I'm reading his book now. It's fantastic. That Which Makes Us Stronger. It's beautiful. So between his novel writing, his memoirs, radio, and he's now directing Our Town, Greg has found some fascinating ways to tell stories and connect with audiences over the years and to come. Well, let's stay in the theater for now, just a little bit longer, because it is time once again for another episode of
The Roving Thespian. Thespian. Thespian.
That's me.
And greetings and salutations, everyone. It is I, the Roving Thespian, Tom Candela here. And today I'm over at the Hurleyville Museum this Sunday afternoon watching a staged reading of a new play called Closets by a gentleman named Bill Duncan. Now, that person, Bill Duncan, and the director of the show, Carol Montana, will be on a future episode of Curtain Call coming in the fall. We are going to talk with some people here. It's a nice size audience. They seem to be enjoying it, and everyone's milling about talking about the show. We're going to talk to some of these folks and get their thoughts. Here with Sissy Goldfarb, also known as Florence Goldfarb.
Thank you.
And she's been watching the show, and she has some comments. First of all, what brought you to the show today?
Well, Bill Duncan, we're friendly with each other, and we found out he had written this play. It's better than I had ever imagined.
Is that right?
Okay. Oh, yes. It's about a family that looks like a regular routine family from the 50s and developing up to the 70s and all of the different flaws that happen. It's really wonderful. It's wonderful.
So you did mention that it's better than you thought, so you're having a good time tonight. You're not uncomfortable with some of the subject matter or anything like that.
No, because I feel it's very true to life. What's going on with the Catholic Church? What goes on between humanity and stuff? It's very refreshing, the idea that this family is recognizing all of these flaws, and I'm really interested to see what's going to happen.
Well, Florence, I want to thank you so much for being part of Curtain Call today.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice to meet you.
Tell us your full name.
Dan Berkowitz.
Tell us a little bit about what your feelings are about this subject matter and about the show itself.
I was pleasantly surprised at the issue that the show tackled, and there were quite a number of very impactful issues, can easily be translated to 2026. So even though it takes place in 1950 and 1970s, race, sexuality, power, abuse, something that we as a world, we as a society, will continue to address. there was an issue of two lesbians. There was an issue of using racially charged words. Those issues have equal weight.
There's a lot of things in this one little play.
Without a doubt, I think this could be used as a primer for addressing the world's ills.
Oh, I love that.
Interestingly, one of the people just made a comment that this form of reading in front of an audience will be an excellent teaching tool in schools.
Oh, that's a good point.
It takes very little to stage and allows certain people, those that have difficulty reading, for example, to be able to sit and read in front of a class. Teachers there, use it.
I love that idea. Well, I want to thank you for being part of Curtain Call.
My name is Danica Delden.
You made a comment during the question and answer period, and you talked about Millie and the trauma that was in her life. Tell us a little bit about your feelings about that.
Sure. So Millie's character was exposed, unfortunately, to some trauma as a child, and it was very clear to me that she was damaged. And as she grew into adulthood, she searched for things to fill the voids that were created, and as a result, her whole family was affected, and they all were damaged in one way or another as a result of her brokenness. Each character had their own difficulties that they were facing and working through or trying to hide until they no longer could. And it was very relatable on so many levels for so many different people. I thought it was well written, it was well portrayed, and I look forward to another reading in the community.
That's great. Did you have any thoughts about the mystery at the end? Who might have done it?
So it was a little tricky, yeah. The way they pointed fingers at one another. I realized in the end who was in cahoots with whom, and yeah, it was well portrayed and unraveled.
And what a great audience we had, too. People stuck around and they asked questions.
Yes, the audience was very intrigued. They were very involved, and the questions that they asked were really thoughtful. We learned more about the characters. We learned more about the origin of this script and how it came to surface. And yeah, it was a very enjoyable afternoon.
And there you have it. You know, one of the real pleasures I have is hosting Curtain Call, is having this opportunity to visit so many theaters throughout our region and experience the wonderful work being done by local artists. Closets, as I said, written by Bill Duncan and beautifully directed by Carol Montana, was certainly just one of those productions. And it was a great afternoon filled with warmth, humor, and some wonderfully authentic performances, some of them by folks you know. I'm pleased to tell you that Bill and Carol will both be joining me for a full episode of Curtain Call later on this fall. We're going to revisit Closets, of course, but we're also going to talk about getting a preview of the mystery dinner theater that Carol is currently developing. Hear more about that then. And if you're planning your next night at the theater, well, here is a look at what's happening on stages throughout our listening area and in the coming weeks. Over at the Forsberg Playhouse. The Forsberg Playhouse will continue their 2026 season with Million Dollar Quartet. That's going to run August 11th, starting tomorrow, Tuesday, through the 23rd. Performances, as I mentioned, Tuesday through Saturday evenings that are at 8 o'clock curtain. And on Wednesday matinees, it's a 2 p.m. and Sunday matinees, it's a 3 p.m. curtain. Then later on in the summer, beginning August the 25th, the Tony Award-winning musical Come From Away takes the stage through September the 6th with the same performance schedule that I mentioned above. For tickets and complete information on both productions, you visit fbplayhouse.org. And Shadowland Stages over in Ellenville, they will be performing Never Can Say Goodbye, the 70s Beehive. That'll open on the 14th of August and run through the 13th. Of September, of course. And the performance schedule is Thursdays through Saturday evenings at 8 and Sunday matinees at 2. Tickets and complete information, visit shadowlandstages.org. Delaware Valley Opera Company, they continued celebrating its 40th anniversary season with Mozart's The Magic Flute. Performances are Saturday evenings the 15th and the 22nd at 7 p.m., and Sunday matinees on August the 16th and 23rd at 2 p.m. For tickets and information, DelawareValleyOpera.com. Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop presents How to Train Your Dragon Jr. That's going to be performed over at the Rivoli Theater in South Fallsburg. Performances are Friday and Saturday evenings, August 15th and 14th and 15th, 21st and 22nd at 7:30 p.m. And there are Sunday matinees, August 16th and the 23rd at 2 p.m. For tickets and information, visit scdw.net. Hurleyville Performing Arts Center on Thursday the 13th at 8 p.m. They will be presenting Music in Commons, Songs and Stories. It's an evening of film, live music, and storytelling benefiting the Sullivan County NAACP. For tickets and information, visit hpacny.org. Phoenicia Playhouse, well, they are concluding their production of Grease through Sunday the 16th, with performances Friday and Saturday evenings at 7 p.m. and a final Sunday matinee at 2 p.m. Then on Saturday the 29th, the Playhouse presents Love's a Joke, an evening of stand-up comedy with performances at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. For tickets and incomplete information on both those events, you go to PhoeniciaPlayhouse.com. NACL Theater, on Saturday the 29th at 7:30 p.m., they will be presenting Immortal, Rise and Fall of the Jermak Battalion, a work-in-progress solo performance exploring the early years of Lebanese civil war through storytelling, sound, and puppetry. I'm going to go to that for sure. Anytime I see puppetry, I got to go. Tickets and complete information on NACL would be at nacl.org. And finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention DVAA, Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, to most of us here. They are presenting a show, Too Stupid to Stop, on Saturday, August the 22nd at 7 p.m. Again, that's a one-night-only performance, folks. August 22nd, 7 p.m. It's going to be over at the Tustin Theater on 210 Bridge Street, Narrowsburg, New York. Too Stupid to Stop will present work both old and new, consisting of play readings, poetry, and live radio. And again, that is going to happen on the 22nd of August. That's a Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. And to get ticket information, as well as learning about all their other performances and productions and events that are happening over at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, you can go to DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. So that's just a sampling of all the wonderful theater and performing arts and dance and music and poetry and writing. And it's just amazing what we have in our region. I hope you'll have the opportunity to support one of those events or perhaps several. So many outstanding productions, particularly in theater, but I am biased. My sincere thanks once again to Greg Triggs for joining me this evening. It was a pleasure getting to know a little bit more about the artist behind the improv and the novels and the memoirs and the many stories he spent a lifetime sharing with audiences. By the way, if you have a comment about tonight's program or one of the other ones, you want to get on the show, suggestion for future shows, call me. Well, I should say, write me. Don't call. Write. If you want to be a guest on Curtain Call, I'd love to hear from you. Just send me an email at tom@wjffradio.org. And until next Monday at 7 p.m., I'm Tom Candela. I want to thank you for listening here on WJFF Radio Catskill to Curtain Call. I do appreciate you tuning in. And so, until next time, see you at the theater.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Bethelwood Center for the Arts, presenting Brandi Carlile with special guest Jensen McRae in concert on the Pavilion Stage August 16th. Tickets on sale now. Ticket information at bethelwoodcenter.org.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You'll clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Donna Fellenberg. Join me Saturdays at 11:30 on Catskill Character for fascinating characters of the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, only on Radio Catskills.